Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, jokes about God. It sounds dangerous, but we speak to the man who's doing a nice job of making a living out of it.
Two teenagers walked into the auditorium and they're wearing t-shirts saying, Richard Dawkins is God. And he looked down and went, oh no, that means I believe I don't exist.
If Darwin had been an agony aunt, he'd probably have sounded something like this.
Your optimal strategy would be to pair bond with the old male, but surreptitiously allow the younger sexy male to fertilise you.
Some chap called Ban Ki-moon tells us about climate change.
In terms of a political leadership, President Obama, you know, he has been instrumental in changing just political dynamics.
Never heard of him. Plus, we head off to a conference on evolution and religion in Egypt.
Reading in this area, or the whole Arabic world, is very little. I think they estimate that the Arabs, in average, they read about a quarter of a page a year.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the studio today, we have the Observer science editor, Robin McKee. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Also here are the Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, and our religious affairs correspondent, Riyazat Butt. Hello, both.
Hello.
More on why Riyazat's here in a minute. But guys, before we go on, we're a bit early for Christmas, I know, but what science presents are you kind of hoping to get, Robin?
A science present. Well, if I can't get a Higgs boson, I'll world peace.
You want a Higgs boson? Oh, I don't know if world peace could be a science present. Riyazat?
I'd like some enriched uranium.
What are you going to do with that?
Going to have a nuclear reactor.
Okay. For electricity purposes, I'm sure. You don't need enriched uranium for that. Anyway, Ian?
I'll just be happy with a hadron.
A hadron. You people are freaks. We've also got a very special treat for this well before Christmas show, a second Robin. This week's special guest is the comedian Robin Ince. He's here to talk about the return of Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People, a variety show on science, atheism and comedy. They're on this week at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London with a super big finale at the Hammersmith Apollo on Sunday. Robin, welcome.
Hello. I'm very glad to be here. As The Guardian last week described me as nerd-in-chief, which I was cock-a-hoop about.
Well, I'm glad you made it, given that you went to the wrong building to start with.
I like science. I hate geography. It's a terrible mix.
For those listening in stereo, by the way, Robin McKee's on the right and Robin Ince is on the left.
Who's left?
Whoever. It's all relative, right? Let's start, Robin Ince, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about this year's show. Now, you were here exactly 12 months ago telling us about the first Nine Lessons. So what's happened this year? Who's debuting this time around? Who have you got coming up? What are the highlights?
Well, some of the new people we've got are Marcus Chown, who did his first gig. I put on a show in the middle of the year for the Year of Astronomy, as it was, which we called Night of 400 Billion Stars and Possibly Some String Theory. And Marcus had never been on stage doing a stand-up kind of thing before. He did five bonkers things about the universe, such as the sun would be the same if it was made of bananas, and about how much empty space there is in the atom.
The sun would be the same if it's made of bananas?
Yes, due to the importance, it's the density which is important,
right,
not actually the matter itself,
okay.
I hope. And so what was great was he went on, he was a bit nervous, and then he came off and he'd got laughs all the way through. He looked so as if this is an entirely new world to me. And the first thing he said to me, I'm a bit worried, did I tread on some of the laughs? I went, don't worry about treading on the laughs. That just means there was a good thing. It would be better that you delicately managed to, you know, walk around the possibility of any laughter would be far more terrible. And we've got Alan Moore, the comic book writer, the genius comic book writer who wrote V for Vendetta and Watchmen. Who else is doing? Johnny Ball is doing quite a few of them as well. Johnny Ball's going to be doing the Hammersmith show and for all the Bloomsbury shows. I didn't want it to be a show that was beating and attacking religion. I wanted it to be a celebration of science. Even that said, I met a man on a pedestrian crossing outside the Courtauld Gallery only yesterday, and he went, oh, hello, I came to your show last year. I was a Catholic till then. And he said, yeah, and then I just realised, this is silly. But that's not our main starting
result,
point.
Result.
Yeah, it was one of those things where, in one way, I felt vaguely guilty, because initially I only wanted people just to start reading Carl Sagan and Richard Feynman. That was the number one task. But it's good that people walk out of the show and start thinking more about the incredible things in the universe. One Catholic newspaper did complain in its review. They went, they didn't have a go at God at all. And I like that. But that really wasn't the initial idea.
Is it surreal having people like Richard Dawkins on a platform with stand-up comics?
I think the surrealism comes in sometimes from the changeover. I think as Jarvis Cocker was singing I Believe in Father Christmas with a 25-piece orchestra, and I knew full well that immediately after him, Richard Dawkins would be talking about ape behaviour and cobweb formation. That's when I realised that it was one of the more obscure and bizarre variety shows. And so this year, again, I hope that we have those kind of magnificent moments. And it was interesting because Richard Dawkins was, I think, slightly nervous in some ways. It's not his normal environment. And there was a great moment where two teenagers walked into the auditorium and they're wearing T-shirts saying, Richard Dawkins is God. And he looked at me and went, oh, no, that means I believe I don't exist. So it was. There were some really nice moments like that as well.
Robin McKee, you're going to be going to some of these shows to write about them critically for The Observer. Well, yep. What are you sort of looking forward to?
I've had a good night out. I didn't see it last year. Shame on me. I'm looking forward to putting that right this year.
But
a bit of reinforcement of my atheistical prejudice. I'm going to be happy that whatever night I go.
What about this conversion aspect? You know, Robin was saying this is not about kicking religion or anything like this, but you were whooping a little bit when he was telling the story about the Catholic chap.
Well, yes, but then I'm a Glaswegian Protestant atheist, not a Catholic atheist.
Oh, one of those, I see.
That's one of my favourite jokes. Yes, yeah. But are you an Anglican Jew or are you a Catholic Jew? Yes. You work out the build-up to that gag.
I couldn't possibly. But why is it that you reckon that so many stand-up comics, for example, are interested in some things like science, I mean, things like physics and evolution and, you know, kind of nerdy things like this?
Well, I don't think it's an enormous number, but I suppose we're quite vocal and we'd like putting on special events. And I think some of it is the one similarity I would say between science and comedy is that scientists look at the world and go, why does that do that? Why is that doing this? And they try and look behind the front of it. In the same way, I think that good comedy is going, why are we behaving like that? Why is that reacting like that? So both of them, I suppose, are melded really by an inquisitive nature.
Ian?
I'm just interested in the, not just interested, but I'm interested in the what the audience is like. I mean, is it mostly pasty men in rock T-shirts? Or what sort of...
Backstage, those are the yeah, Marcus Chown, yeah. Yes, is dressed like
if an
like
asteroid
that.
Hit Bloomsbury Theatre next week, would you take out like 90% of the nerds in London? Or?
Well, this is it, because I did a gig last week at the Lowry Centre in Salford where with Simon Singh and Ben Goldacre and Josie Long, and I'm always interested when I go out and say, how many scientists do we have in? It's normally, I would say, about a quarter to a third, and a lot of the people are not scientists, they are interested. And we do have, what was great about last year is some of the older kind of secular movement people. There are a lot of people in their 90s who hang around Conway Hall, you know, smelling old books by Bertrand Russell. They were quite amazed by the number of 16, 17-year-olds there. And yeah, we've got goths, we've got librarians, and we've also just got people who are maybe only coming to see one comedian. Maybe they're there to see Dara O'Brien. And then afterwards they go, wow, I didn't know that. But it's a very open audience, I think.
Dara O'Brien's quite impressively knowledgeable about science, actually. I've seen him on various panel shows just talking about Higgs bosons and all sorts of things.
He knows a triple point of water.
I have to look it up. The whole thing's being organised with the Rationalist Association, who published a new humanist magazine. And the Rationalist Association are a charity dedicated to science and reason. There's more information on all of this stuff at newhumanist.org. And I think at time of recording, there are some tickets left for the 20th of December, is that right?
Yes, that's the only
and,
of tickets.
And stay listening if you want to win a pair of tickets later. Robin's going to come up with a competition in between now and the end of the show.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. This is the News Jam.
News Jam.
The past 10 years have been the warmest in recorded history. The figures come from the UK's Met Office and have been released at the UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. Despite 1998 being the warmest year on record, the noughties has been the warmest decade recorded in 160 years. The raw data from 1,500 monitoring stations has also been released in an effort to satisfy critics in the wake of the email hacking row at the University of East Anglia.
A review of Tamiflu published in the British Medical Journal has accused its manufacturer of withholding evidence from trials. Doctors allege that Roche has made it impossible for scientists to assess how well the anti-flu drug works. Using what data there is in the public domain, they've found no evidence Tamiflu can prevent healthy people with flu from suffering complications such as pneumonia. In a response, Roche says it firmly believes in the robustness of the data and that governments and licensing authorities had been given access to all the trial information.
The world's oldest independent scientific research organisation appears to be in crisis. Senior figures at the Royal Institution have drawn up plans for a restructure which could force the departure of Britain's most prominent female scientist. Lady Greenfield, head of the institution, has been in the role for 10 years. The changes have come about in an effort to save money amid the financial downturn. The changes have split the governing body and senior figures have already quit.
While NASA is planning what to do next, Richard Branson has unveiled his new flying machine. Virgin's Galactic Spaceship 2 has been shown off to celebrities in the Mojave Desert. The entrepreneur promises to take tourists out of the Earth's atmosphere as soon as 2011. 300 or more future astronauts have pledged £122,000 each for a place on board Spaceship 2 and the chance to boldly go where only a handful of professional space travellers have gone before.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about one of the two of those stories. Ian, the Royal Institution story is the one that sort of so people have followed up this week. You broke that last week. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, first of all, we know that the Royal Institution is in financial dire straits, which it is going to really struggle to come out of. But separately, there appears to be moves going on within the council that sort of governs it. To remove Susan Greenfield now as the director of the Royal Institution. Now, the explanation, if you like, for the council puts forward is that this is a cost-saving measure. They basically reviewed all the jobs that are senior jobs, which are sort of 70-odd grand jobs, and they decided that Susan Greenfield's was the most expensive and the least necessary, so they thought they might try and cut this, but she disagrees and would rather keep her job. So this is all still an ongoing mess, to be fair, about what they do to, you know, get the finances back on track, and also what they do about having a leader.
Okay, getting away from this sort of Susan Greenfield issue for a sec here, Robin, is there a risk that if a group like the Royal Institution, which is one of the old sort of traditional places that science used to be done in London, used to be done around the world. Mm. This is Faraday's home. Yeah. Is it a bit sad that they are in dire straits like this? What happens to them?
It's rather nice, been rather nicely done up. It's got its restaurant there. It's got its bar. It's, you know, it's got potential. It's it would be a tragedy if it was to go. It's, you know, it's got that accessibility and that prestige. Prestige of the Royal Society, but an accessibility that the Royal Society doesn't have.
Well, talking about one of the great discoveries of science, let's go to Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic. So he's selling very expensive tickets up to suborbital flights around the world. He's unveiled Spaceship 2, not the most inspired name, but...
No, but it was a logical progression, I suppose, after Spaceship 1 won the Ansari X Prize.
This is Bert Rutan's ship that won the X Prize, and then Virgin Galactic come along and say, right, well, we'll buy it off you, make a bigger one for us, and we'll sell tickets to space.
That's right, and you've got to love some of the enthusiasm in the terminology that comes out with obviously from Virgin Galactic, but also from the rest of the media who cover this. I mean, there's in the unveiling in the Mojave Desert that Branson did with sort of surprisingly attractive women draped over geeks and engineers and things like this, which doesn't often happen. And sort of cocktail and champagne do. They also unveiled, you know, White Knight 2, which is basically a big plane that carries Spaceship 2 up to 50,000 feet. But of course, in the media, in certain places in the media, it's not a carrier plane, it's a mothership, which means, you know, which makes you think that it's some sort of huge, stonking, great big thing that just hovers quietly with a few lights flashing on it. And it's really just a big aeroplane. But, you know, that carries up Spaceship 2, and then it drops Spaceship 2 about 50,000 feet in the air, 16 kilometres, and then it just fires a rocket and goes for it. It's suborbital, so let's not get too excited. I mean, we're not going to
go... You're waitlist for a few minutes. It's hardly even that.
Yeah, and there's no toilet on Spaceship 2. Wow. There's no space for luggage. There's no trolley service.
I'll tell you something. Having been on a parabolic flight where you are weightless on a regular basis, there are no toilets in them because they wouldn't know what to do with the liquid waste.
That's what put me off being an astronaut. I can't remember which space mission it was that one of them had diarrhea. And they had, which one was that mission? It was in several,
I think.
Yeah, and just the grotesque image of them floating around, picking up each piece. And that was the point. I want to be an astronaut. I don't want to be an astronaut. I'm going to go back to being a zookeeper.
Surely they've got strong hoovers.
They don't have NASA-designed anal plugs.
This programme is just going downhill.
On that note, we'll stop that there. For everything you want to know about this story, go to guardian.co.uk/science, where Ian will inform you about everything in detail.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
A quick fix now on the United Nations climate talks taking place in Copenhagen. We're not going to do too much as things there keep changing so quickly. But what we will do is pure gold. The Guardian's US environment correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg, spoke to the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon just before the start of the second week of the conference. This is what the statesman had to say about the influence President Obama is having on the proceedings.
In terms of level of commitment, it may fall, below the expectation. But in terms of political leadership, President Obama, he has been instrumental in changing this political dynamics. The wind of these discussions of this climate change toward the right direction. From day one, he said the U.S. government will be committed and will participate in this negotiation. That was a great message. Then his participation in a summit meeting in November, that was for the first time any U.S. president to come. President Bush participated only in informal dinner. Then he's coming to the Copenhagen summit meeting, again has helped changing this dynamics. That's the leadership. In that regard, I hope he can come with a much more ambitious target. That's my hope. But I also appreciate all this was happening in the U.S. Domestic politics.
For the most comprehensive take you could possibly want on Copenhagen, you can do no wrong if you click on environmentguardian.co.uk. If you were to head over to the Guardian Science website anytime soon, you might notice something new. No, it's not another Large Hadron Collider page, or even anything on dark matter. No, it's an agony aunt, and not just any agony aunt. It's an evolutionary agony aunt. Her name is Carol Jamie. She wants to help you with your problems, and you can be assured that all of her advice is based on the very latest in modern evolutionary science. Here's a taster of her service. Choosing a mate, what is a girl to do? From Carrie, age 33, by email.
I haven't got children but want kids. There are two men in my life. There's a lovely older guy, age 53. He's sophisticated and engaging and very kind, and I love his company. But recently I met a 28-year-old guy. He's sexy, full of energy, and I feel really attracted to him. He's newly arrived in Britain from Poland, and he's unemployed. I don't know who to choose.
Carol replies,
a worldwide study of sexual preferences revealed that females feel more secure if they have a mate in reserve. The older male is established and able to offer you security and thus provide for any children you may have with him. But you should be aware that male fertility and the condition of sperm decline with age. The younger male, on the other hand, is likely to have a higher sperm count. However, the sexy son hypothesis states that sons born of sexy strangers will mature to become sexy men in themselves, thus providing granny with plenty of grandchildren. Some Darwinists might say your optimal strategy would be to pair bond with the old male, but surreptitiously allow the younger sexy male to fertilise you. But be careful. Most men consider being cuckolded the greatest of betrayals.
We'll try to get Carol onto the podcast in a few weeks. But in the meanwhile, send your questions to science@guardian.co.uk and put Ask Carol, that's Carol with an E at the end, by the way, in the subject line. And read those terms and conditions as well on the blog. There's no getting away from Darwin this year. It's all evolution, evolution, evolution. A few weeks ago, our religious affairs correspondent, Riaz Akbutt, was lucky enough to end up in Alexandria, in Egypt, to attend a 3-day jamboree on Darwin's living legacy. The meeting also looked at the social and cultural impact of Darwin's work. The delegates, which included scientists and religious leaders, discussed how evolution is taught and also the spectre of creationism, which is casting a bigger and bigger shadow over science education.
I'm Shubha Tole, Associate Professor in the Department of Biological Sciences in the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in Mumbai, India.
Will our brains evolve to do more?
Studies that I know of indicate that brain size has sort of been optimized already, in that the human brain is as big as it could have gotten in terms of the baby being actually born. The baby has to come out of the mother without killing the mom, and the human brain, the baby's brain, has gotten as big as it could have. How might brain function be evolved or optimized? We can always do more with our brains, or we can always do things differently. And I think humans, if anything, have specialized at that. We've taken the same processor, the same cerebral cortex that we've had for thousands of years, and begun to do different things with it. Take, as an example, this amazing activity which we take for granted, reading. Okay, you know, cave people did not read. They didn't have letters and scripts and so on. The same processors that were used to recognize shapes and you know, give us survival instincts of being able to see the lion in the bushes and run away from it, or see the gazelle and get food, the same processors have been used to now recognize these funny squiggles on paper that we call letters, and we make them into words, and that gets connected up into a whole semantic processing unit, and we get language. So reading is a really strange activity. It's not something that we were sort of born to do, in a sense, but it's something that we have chosen to do with our fantastic cerebral cortex. And who knows what next? We have been able to expand our function in many, many ways already. We've not particularly grown more fingers or more arms, but we've invented the keyboard. So many of us, in fact, I would say I'm guilty of this. The keyboard is an extension of me. Take it away and I feel incomplete, and certainly I can do much less. So I think we need to talk about this aspect of evolution of human enterprise as part of what the human species is going to achieve. It's not just bigger brains. It's what you do with them.
My name is Magdi El-Maliki. I'm a professor at the School of Medicine in Shams University. After I passed my 60 years, I started to take interest of having a hobby. So I took translation as a hobby, and I fell for Darwin. And since then, I haven't left it for the past 10 years.
How many of his works have you translated?
I've translated up to now the main book, which is The Origin of Species. Then after this, followed by The Descent of Man and Sexual Selection, which came in 3 volumes.
Is this the first time that somebody has translated Darwin's works into Arabic, or that so many of his works have been translated?
No, the only attempts that happened before, and this is the first time Darwin was mentioned and evolution in this area, it was in 1916. By a Lebanese guy called Shibli Shmail, who just wrote an article about him. Then one of our best translators and writers called Ismail, he started translating the book, but I don't know why it took him so many years, and he died before he finished it. And he was not a scientist, so he wrote beautiful words, but he missed some of the scientific issues of the book. Since that, nobody attempted that. It's a very difficult book, very difficult writing, 150 years old. Darwin's sentences amount to 25 lines in one sentence. So it was, you know, that difficult. The other books, nobody touched at all. So I was the first one mad enough to do it.
How popular have the translations been?
Not very much. Reading in this area, or the whole Arabic world, is very little. I think they estimate that the Arabs, in average, they read about a quarter of a page a year.
Rialza, run us through some of the topics of this meeting. Looking at the schedule, it seemed like there's 1,000 different things happening. What did you sort of pick out?
Well, it was a very curious conference because some of it was pure science, looking at how humans have evolved to eat cooked food, to how creationism differs in different Abrahamic traditions. So there seemed to be something for everybody. There was a lot of focus on how evolution is taught, how it's understood, what people's reactions are to it, but also what science teachers know about science. And I got the feeling that they didn't know very much. So as well as looking at evolution as a subject and all its offshoots, people were also very concerned about how science is taught in classrooms, because that obviously informs how people feel about science and how they interact with it.
This is people from all over the world. So this is science teachers from all over the world, you know, talking about the sort of curriculums in their countries.
Yeah, it was a very broad geographical mix, and also socially too. And it wasn't just sort of Western imperialists telling, you know, people from developing countries what they should think about evolution. You know, you had people from South America, you had people from the subcontinent, from the Middle East. So it was a very broad church in that respect, and I think that was very good, bringing all of those people together under one roof.
So one of the subjects that we talked about in the intro, which was discussed here, was, you said, creationism. I mean, what was the thrust of the conference in terms of thinking? Did everyone think this is a terrible, terrible thing, and we have to try and stamp out any sort of discussions about creationism because it's just silly? Or were people trying to understand creationism and maybe talk about it in a sort of sensible way?
I don't think anybody was saying that there should be any sympathy towards creationism and intelligent design. Michael Reese was there, and he was one of the people who was arguing that creationism should be discussed in science classrooms and that it shouldn't be rejected automatically, because that way people will just become defensive and they'll stick to creationism as a worldview, whereas if you educate them about evolution, then they're more likely to accept the evidence for it.
He was the guy who was sacked from the Royal Society for saying those things, and he was the director of education at the Royal Society, and some would say unfairly sacked for saying something which is fairly sensible, I think. I wouldn't say necessarily you should teach these things in science lessons, but that you should engage them in some way. I mean, either of the Robins. I mean, do you have thoughts on this? Where does creationism sit? We've discussed this so many times before, but it's worth going over again.
Well, I think creationism and intelligent design are brilliant for one lesson in science, and in that lesson you describe why creationism and intelligent design are not science, and you can do that in a very cold way. You explain the scientific method. You explain. You could talk about Popper and falsifiability, whatever you want. But there is a way of actually using it, I think, in a very positive way, to say you can keep this as a faith position, but this is why these things are not science in what is currently deemed to be science.
I think he's right.
Was there a sense that religion otherwise gets in the way of teaching science? Or, you know, what was the discussion around that?
I think there was a reluctance, but general acceptance that religious beliefs are interfering in the way that people absorb science and scientific evidence. And again and again, I was asking people, because I wasn't quite satisfied with the answers, I was asking people, why does it matter what people's beliefs are? And eventually a few people did come back to me and say, because if people do not accept the factual evidence for evolution, if they don't accept the scientific evidence that's there, the chances are that should they go on to work in any scientific field, that future diagnoses and conclusions will be wrong, because they allow their personal beliefs to interfere.
And you don't have faith-based trials.
You should not view science through a religious filter, and I think you should keep the two separate. So the academics and the scientists who were there were slightly frustrated that they were actually having to expend their energy and resources on this.
At the conference, you've got people from all over the world. So we talk about these subjects from a very Western point of view. And of course, in the Enlightenment here, we believe that the evidence is the best way to sort of move forward when you're thinking about stuff. But not everyone's going to think in the same way. I mean, what about people from, you know, India or China or Africa or lots of other places where there might be a slightly different way of sort of approaching these sorts of problems? Or teaching creationism even, all that sort of stuff.
Well, one of the interesting sessions and remarks came from a Middle Eastern scientist who said that he'd done a study among Egyptian and Lebanese secondary school students, and he asked about their attitudes towards evolution and creationism to try and decipher what their methodology was and what their beliefs were and what they understood to be fact or not. And he showed that religious beliefs interfered in people's understanding of science, and it wasn't just the students who were affected, it was the science teachers as well. So a lot of students were being taught by teachers who didn't accept the evidence for evolution. And so that's actually really worrying, because these were science students who were very bright. They were going to go on to medical school. They'll go on to work in hospitals. They'll go on to work in other fields as well. And so potentially you have a whole generation of people for whom it is normal to have their judgment affected by belief and superstition.
Well, I thought it was interesting. You, I thought, were a little bit wishy-washy there. We believe here that the best system may well be rationalism and empiricism and evidence. It is. It really is. The reason that all of us are here and alive and the reason that medicine has moved forward, that I think we don't need to get too caught up in the idea of going, I know this is... And it's not just a Western thing. You know, across the world, there are many people in Uganda where the mustard seed school is, where there are people fighting to have more rationalism there. And I think we don't need to tiptoe around it. We can go, no, it really is the best system. That's why there are more people alive. There are more people who manage to survive disease and other rancorous things. It's not faith.
It's the best system because it's the one that works.
Yes.
It's the one that works and it keeps repeating itself. Rob McKee, though, last word to you then in that case. What do you think, what Riaz there was saying, that there's a generation of people clearly in the Middle East, for example, or other places where you can become a doctor by and still not really necessarily believe that evolution is true or think in a sort of scientific way. Is that dangerous?
Yes, it's dangerous because, I mean, the whole bedrock of biology today and the understanding of biology is the theory of natural selection. Biology makes no sense unless you have an understanding of natural selection and a full acceptance of it. So, yes, it's going to be dangerous.
Let's take a quick look now at what you've been saying about this podcast on the blogs. Stotist responded to last week's pre-Copenhagen special.
An interesting, if depressing, podcast. Personally, I think that geoengineering is our only hope now, in combination with a mass die-off of all those idiots of the energy lobby. Alan Anderson suggested the melting of the summer sea ice will provide the final wake-up call. On current evidence, I would have to disagree. The usual suspects would deny it has ever happened, say the photos are rigged by liberals, or that there was never any sea ice anyway.
On Twitter, Sohanlon07 said,
"This isn't so much an environmental issue as a human health issue. The planet has been here far longer than us, and we'll be here well after we are gone. The question is whether we've got the intelligence to prevent our own extinction, or at the very least, delay the cull that nature will inflict on this destructive species."
Finally, Lenny Antonelli said, "Have to say, Football Weekly podcast is pretty great, almost as good as Science Weekly." Thanks, Andy's mum, for that. Join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall. Approaching the 1,500 members mark there, a mere fraction of all you listening right now, as we know. Leave your thoughts also on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, and you can follow us on Twitter, search for Science Weekly or Guardian Science.
Science Weekly.
Before we wind up the podcast, Robin Ince, you've got a couple of tickets to give away, perhaps, to some of our listeners for one of your gigs. How are they going to get hold of these?
Well, for the show Hammersmith Apollo on the 20th, I should mention the scientists, by the way, who are Simon Singh, Brian Cox, Richard Dawkins, and Ben Goldegg from Endara, Brian and Al Murray, and Chris Allison, etc. I don't know what's the most modern way to do it. If they go to my... leave a message for me at Twitter, which is obviously just at Robin Ince. The first one, which has an interesting fact about aphids, which can include honeydew-based aphids. If they were the first interesting fact I get, I will reply to them and give them two free tickets.
Do you want them to hashtag something?
If they put Guardian Podcast and they just put at Robin Ince.
You can find details of that all on our blog, of course, at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you'd do well to head over to newhumanist.org as well if you want to find out some more details on the shows. Thanks to Robin Ince, also to Ian Sample, Robin McKee and Riaz Butt. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Next week, it'll be a special podcast from Copenhagen on what, if any, climate change agreement they've come up with. It'll be an earlier edition of Science Weekly to coincide with the end of the talks, and it'll be ready to download on Saturday.
I'll just be happy with a hadron.
I thought you said a hard-on, sorry. I
don't know. Well, actually, it's an anagram of
that
hard-on.
That was the joke, you idiots.